Next, Monitor invites you to Meet the Press, America's press conference of the year, and winner of every major award in its field. Our guest today is William E. Miller, a member of Congress from Upper New York State, and recently elected chairman of the Republican National Committee. We'll bring you today's program after this message.
This is Leon Pearson. The music is from East Africa, from Tanganyika, the first foreign country to request aid from our Peace Corps. Soon a group of young Americans, civil engineers, surveyors, geologists, will assist this newly emerging nation in a road-building project. On December 9th, Tanganyika will achieve independence. One state is emerging after another. All of Africa is changing at a breathtaking pace. And in recognition of the increasingly vital role of African nations in world affairs, NBC News has established a full-time African News Bureau to coordinate network coverage of that continent. Whatever African development assumes importance in the news, NBC will be on the scene. You're never out of tune with the world when you're in tune with Radio NBC.
This season of the year has been designated National Allergy Month because hay fever is the most common of the allergic diseases, and the peak of the hay fever season is between August the 15th and September the 15th. If you wish to learn more about allergy or one of the allergic diseases, why not write today to the Allergy Foundation of America for the free pamphlet Asthma, Hay Fever, and Other Allergies. Just address a card to Box 1005, New York City, 17. And now, Meet the Press. Today's guest on Meet the Press is Congressman William E. Miller, recently elected chairman of the Republican National Committee. Our panel consists of Richard Wilson, Kohl's Publications, May Craig, Portland, Maine Press Herald, Robert Abernathy, NBC News, and Lawrence E. Spivak. Now here is our moderator, Ned Brooks.
The role of the opposition in a two-party system is both difficult and delicate in time of crisis. How a party meets the test has a profound effect not only on the issue at stake, but on the future of the party as well. In recent months, the United States has been confronted with difficult policy decisions, both in the foreign field and on the home front. Because there is a need for unity and for critical examination, the Republicans, as the minority party, have great responsibilities. Our guest today is the chairman of the Republican National Committee, Congressman William E. Miller of New York. He was first elected to Congress in 1950. He was chosen to head the party 3 months ago after serving as the chairman of the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee. Under his leadership, the Republicans gained 21 seats in the House of Representatives in the last election. And now we're ready for questions, Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Chairman, the New York Times, in an editorial recently, had this to say: the show of an almost solid phalanx, Republicans joining up with conservative Democrats in opposition to the administration's foreign aid program, smacks all too much of politics as usual and a gamble with national and free world destiny. Is there a Republican policy on the foreign aid measure?
Well, in the first place, Mr. Spivak, the premise upon which the New York Times predicates its assertions is incorrect. In 1960, as a matter of fact, on 300 roll call votes, the Southern Democrats voted with the Republicans only about 20% of the time. Southern conservatives may from time to time agree with certain positions of the Republican Party in areas of fiscal responsibility or backdoor spending or states' rights or whatever it may be, but there is no coalition as such between and among Southern Democrats and the Republicans.
Is there a Republican policy, though, on the foreign aid bill?
Of course there's a Republican policy on the foreign aid bill.
Can you tell us what
it is? We have always supported foreign aid. We supported it as a party during the Truman administration. We supported it as a party during the Eisenhower years. We're supporting foreign aid now. As a substantive program, the congressional procedures as to financing, we differ with this administration, but we have supported by and large, a foreign aid program, all during the Eisenhower years.
But you are against, the party policy is against what is called the heart of the president's foreign aid program, which is long-term treasury borrowing. Is that
well,
so?
But I don't, again, accept your premise that that's the heart of the program. I say the heart of the program is the amount of the appropriation. And we've had foreign aid in this country for some 15 or 16 years. We've never had backdoor spending. We've built dams and other carried on other civil functions here in the United States for our own people for years and years without any backdoor spending. We have a $45 billion annual appropriation for military defense, which requires long-term planning for submarines and airplanes and missiles. We've never had to do it by backdoor financing, but by annual appropriations. Now, I say the substance of the foreign aid bill is the appropriation on an annual basis for foreign aid purposes. And I maintain that the congressional procedure of authorizing or permitting backdoor spending or requiring annual appropriations is merely a procedural and not a substantive part of the foreign aid program.
Well, am I to understand, though, that the party has taken a policy position on this, then?
Yes, the party in Congress, as far as the Republican Policy Committee in the House is concerned, has taken a position against backdoor spending. We have agreed, I think under Congressman Walter Judd and Congressman Halleck, we offered to this administration a four-year authorization program with annual appropriations. We are opposed, as a matter of policy, to any backdoor spending for such a period of, say, 5 years as requested by the administration.
Have you had any indication that that will be accepted by the administration and that's likely to be the bill that'll come out of
the joint?
To date,
we've had no indication the administration has accepted. No.
Mr. Abernethy. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions about the future of the Republican Party in the South. You said last week in North Carolina that the biggest political news today is the growing tendency of Southern voters to support the Republican Party on the local and state level. Would you tell us now what you expect in the way of Republican victories in the South in next year's congressional elections and in the presidential election of 1964?
Well, I was in North Carolina when I made that statement, and I feel very surely that we'll gain at least one and possibly two seats in congressional seats in North Carolina. I think as a result of the reapportionment in Florida and the fact that they are gaining congressional seats in Florida, will net us at least one and possibly two additional seats in Florida because there are just too many Republicans in Florida to keep us foreclosed within the limitations of one congressional district. I think there is a very excellent chance that we will win the congressional seat in the San Antonio district, which will be by way of a special election in December as a result of the resignation of Congressman Kilday. I think that we have an excellent chance of picking up an additional seat in Virginia. I think that we will make definite gains throughout the South as far as our congressional picture is concerned.
And in 64?
In 64, I would say that we would do certainly as well as we have done in 52 and 56 and 60 and perhaps better. The total vote for the Republican candidates for the governorships of the southern states, for instance, 1960, was over 1.5 million votes more than the votes 2 years previous.
You've spoken many times of the importance of improving Republican strength in the big cities in the North, and most big cities have large Negro populations. Would you tell us something of your specific plans for appealing to both the Negroes in the big cities in the North and to more and more people in the South?
Well, my answer to that is this, that our party is very firm on the matter of civil rights. We don't talk differently in the South than we do in the North on the issue of civil rights. We have a record on civil rights. We freed the slaves. We passed two civil rights bills during the Eisenhower years. We stand fast on the platform provisions which we enacted in Chicago in 1960. What we have to do as far as the minority groups in the large cities are concerned is to do a better job of selling our story, do a better job of transmitting to them the true facts of the situation and what we have as a party done for those people and what our record really is in the area of civil rights. We have to make better use of certain newspapers and radio stations, for instance, that we have in the past, which are beamed to these particular people, so that our message is carried more emphatically and more broadly. We need better precinct organizations in those districts. We need better grassroots organizations, so to speak. We need more muscle in the large city. But certainly this has nothing to do with my discussion of our gains in the South, because while our position on civil rights is just the same and just as strong as is the Democratic position, and our record better, nevertheless, in many other areas, the people of the South will find that their ideals and aspirations find a better home in our party. That is, a fiscal responsibility and a reduction of bureaucracy and a lessening of governmental expenditures and all of those things which I think appeal to the people of the South and appeal to Americans generally, I believe, today.
Mrs. Craig.
Now, Mr. Chairman, whom do you regard as the leader of the Republican Party now?
I regard ex-Vice President Nixon as the titular leader of our party. I think when a major party assembles in convention and nominates a candidate for president, that historically and traditionally he remains the titular head of our party until such time as, whether he wins or loses, until such time as our party meets in convention again and nominates someone for president.
Well then, Mr. Chairman, why did you even suggest the ticket such as Rockefeller and Goldwater? Or was it Goldwater and Rockefeller? Time said it was Goldwater and Rockefeller. Was it both?
Well, it's been quoted about 8 different ways, Mrs. Craig.
Well, what did you say?
The answer was taken out of context. That was on a program in which I was asked if the differences between Rockefeller and Goldwater, or the differences between Goldwater and Nixon, or Nixon and Rockefeller, were so vast and so deep and so irreconcilable that a ticket made up of any two or of those men would be incompatible. And my answer was that in my judgment it would not be incompatible. And I don't think there are those vast differences between the people named. I think that there are vast areas of agreement. There's been too much emphasis on the areas of disagreement and not enough on the areas of agreement. And that I would not think that a ticket of Nixon or Goldwater or Rockefeller or Nixon would be any more incompatible than a ticket of President Kennedy and Vice President Johnson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you regard Mr. Nixon as the leader of the party, why do you not present him more? You're always presenting the former President Eisenhower as the image of the party, are you not?
I'm presenting President Eisenhower as the image of the party because of the fact that I do believe that that the middle of the road approach followed by the Eisenhower-Nixon administration is more or less the position of our party today. But I have not been aware of the fact that I have downgraded Mr. Nixon. I have tried to answer such questions that have been posed to me as to whom I think might be possibly candidates of our party in 1964, who might be selected, but I have very frequently mentioned Dick Nixon in connection with questions asked concerning
Chairman,
the leadership
of
the party or our possible candidate in 1964.
At the big dinner that you had here out to the Armory, Mr. Nixon wasn't even here, and President Eisenhower was presented as the image of the party.
Well, but at the same night, Mrs. Craig, Mr. Nixon was a speaker at a similar function in California. And as you know, this was a fundraising dinner here in California, and we simultaneously had a fundraising dinner in California addressed by Vice President Nixon. And in that way, we were able to have a wider coverage, may I say.
That was arranged, was it not?
No,
Mr.
not
Chairman.
At all. Not at all.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Miller, I assume you were quoted correctly as having said that the Republican National Committee does not make policy for the party.
That is true.
Who does make policy for the party?
Well, I would say that that in the absence of the White House and in the absence of the executive departments of government, that the policy of our party is made by the legislative leaders in the House and Senate, by the governors, the Republican governors we have in the various states, generally speaking, those Republican leaders who are recognized as being spokesmen for and leaders of our party. Actually, we adopted a platform in Chicago in 1964. As far as I know, that platform has not been repudiated by any of the leading Republicans. I think it was then. I think it is now. The policy of our party and reflects the positions of our party in matters of interest today, both foreign and domestic.
Yes, but I wonder if new conditions have not arisen since the Republican convention a year ago, more than a year ago, and new conditions, particularly with respect to Berlin. Has there been any meeting of governors or legislative leaders or other leaders of the party to determine what the Republican Party policy is on this very vital question?
No, I think this is, at this time, I think this pretty much has been covered by and is reflected by the statements issued by the Republican Policy Committee in the House and the Republican Policy Committee in the Senate. I think that you're referring, I imagine, of course, to the fact that during the Eisenhower years, the Democratic Party had the Democratic Advisory Council, but at the same time, this didn't certainly reflect the policy of the Democratic Party because they were not in full accord with, in their pronouncements, with the pronouncement of their legislative leaders who were then in control of the House and Senate.
No, the point I'm getting at is whether the Republican Party has any policy with respect to Berlin and whether it is a unified policy.
I think we have a policy in respect to Berlin. We had one during the Eisenhower years, and it hasn't changed one single iota. We had an ultimatum, too, you know, from Mr. Khrushchev during President Eisenhower's years. And our policy then and our policy now has been that we stand firm in Berlin. And to the extent that President Kennedy stands firm in Berlin, so will we stand behind him.
Yes, but the additional point is, would the Republican Party advocate that the United States fight to preserve the status of Berlin today?
I think the Republican Party takes the position that that President Kennedy today is the commander-in-chief. To the extent he stands firm in Berlin, he knows the facts and is aware of the entire situation. To the extent that he stands firm in Berlin, we will stand behind him. At any time that he thinks that such firmness necessitates war, then of course the Republicans would stand with him.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Miller, if you were running a national campaign against the Democrats today, what would be the leading issues as you see them?
Well, I think there would be many. In the first place, I think that we would have the issue of lack of firmness and carry through and lack of decisiveness in the areas of foreign policy. President Kennedy made several statements in his news conferences as to what he was going to do in Laos and how firm he was going to stand, and he failed to carry through. We certainly have an issue in regard to the Cuban fiasco. We certainly have an issue, it seems to me, in regard to the continuing discussions at Geneva in regard to disarmament and the ban on nuclear testing, with apparently no date being set for a termination or a breakoff date. We certainly would have the issues, I think, that we've added 66,000 people to the payroll. We've increased federal expenditures by about $49 million a day. The rate of unemployment is just about the same as it was. The gross national product hasn't increased any more than it did in the comparable period under the Eisenhower years. I think that we might well say that they promised to follow through and to get the country moving. They haven't yet produced a civil rights bill. They haven't yet produced any tax reform legislation. They haven't yet produced a school bill. I think that we have plenty of issues.
On the Berlin issue, am I to understand that you and the Republicans are critical of...
I didn't understand you.
I say, on the Berlin issue, am I to understand that you and the Republicans are critical of the president, that he isn't standing firm enough?
No, I didn't say that.
No, I'm asking you the question.
I say this, that the president has indicated that he is standing and intends to stand firm in Berlin. Now, all I say is that so long as he remains firm in that position, we will stand with him. As a matter of fact, we're doing much for him than many of his own cohorts. No responsible Republican has suggested, as did Senator Mansfield, that it become a free city under international control. No responsible Republican, as far as I know, has indicated, as Senator Fulbright, that we might negotiate the way, away the rights of people in East Berlin to come to freedom in West Berlin. I say as long as he stands firm, we will be with him. But I'm wondering if the chickens haven't come home to roost. I'm wondering if the statements during the campaign of the United States being a second-rate military power and second in prestige, and I'm wondering if the indecisiveness in Laos, the indecisiveness in Cuba, and the indecisiveness of Geneva, and the fact that when President Kennedy went to Vienna and then came back, he failed to disclose to the American people he'd been given an ultimatum by Khrushchev. I'm wondering if all of these things perhaps has made Mr. Khrushchev
think... What do you mean he failed to disclose that he'd been given an ultimatum? Do you know that he was given an ultimatum by Mr. Khrushchev?
Yes, because now Mr. Khrushchev announced this and President Kennedy has admitted it, that he did receive the ultimatum. And it took 40 days and 40 nights, I might add, for this administration to answer the ultimatum on a separate peace treaty with East Germany.
What was the ultimatum? I didn't understand that. I didn't understand that it was any different from the one that was given in 58.
It wasn't any different, but it was a new ultimatum. It was an ultimatum handed to President Kennedy. Well, nothing new. That's the amazing thing, that it took this administration 40 days and 40 nights to respond to the ultimatum handed to President Kennedy when it required no new posture and indicated no new position or required no new thought.
Mr. Abernathy.
Mr. Chairman, do you think that the U.S. and its allies should now offer to negotiate with the Soviet Union on Berlin?
Mr. Abernathy, as I say, the position of the Republicans is that we remain firm. What is there to negotiate as far as Berlin is concerned? We are in West Berlin as a matter of right, as a matter of war victory, as a matter of fact. We have a right to air and land corridors to West Berlin and ingress and egress from West Berlin. Now, what is there for us to negotiate as far as Berlin is concerned?
Is the answer then that we should not offer to negotiate?
I certainly would not at this time, under an ultimatum from Mr. Khrushchev, I would not think that in the face of an ultimatum, I would think there would be anything to be gained by negotiation. We're asking nothing we're not entitled to. We're exercising no rights we have. We have no legal right to do. We are exercising vested rights. Now, what is there for us to negotiate? Anytime Mr. Khrushchev may indicate that he's willing to negotiate and willing to make concessions himself, then this might be cause for negotiation. But I could see no reason why the United States should be anxious to negotiate. There's nothing to negotiate.
Mrs. Craig.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in a speech in Michigan in July, you said, quote, there should be no retreat from Berlin, no more appeasement of communists. Do you claim that the present administration has been appeasing the communists?
Well, I don't know what you would call it, Mrs. Craig, but I say that when you make a statement that the communists are going to gain no further territory in Laos, and then you stand by for 4 or 5 weeks and let them capture the capital city of Padang and other areas of strategic importance in Laos, when you commit American prestige to the invasion of Cuba and don't commit enough American power to succeed, when you have Chester Bowles indicating that he thinks perhaps we should have a two-China position, when you have Mr. Stevenson indicating that perhaps we should admit Red China to the United Nations, then I think that it's time that we became firm in our position around the world in regard to this communist situation, and I think that I think there's no firmness has been shown in Geneva. There's been no indication that they intend to cut off negotiations if the communists don't do something pretty soon about reaching some specific, tangible, workable agreements.
Mr. Chairman, your successor as chairman of the Congressional Campaign Committee, Republican, says there's been a general softening of the administration attitude toward communism. Now, do you agree with that, and are you going to make that an item in your campaign? for the coming elections?
It will depend, of course, upon events. I say that in the events in Laos, the events in Cuba, the events in Geneva, the events in Vienna, the statements of Mr. Bowles, the statements of Mr. Stevenson, to me indicate, and apparently to my successor, Mr. Wilson, a general attitude of appeasement in this area of dealing with communism around the world.
We have about, about a minute and a half. Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Miller, the Gallup poll published today, I think, reported that about 60% of the Republicans favor the nomination for president in 1964 of Mr. Nixon. Do you think that reflects, is an accurate reflection of Republican Party opinion?
I would not argue with it, Mr. Wilson. It must be remembered that less than 9 months ago, Dick Nixon was our candidate for President of the United States, and he received over 34 million votes, a little less than one-half of 1% of the total vote cast. Now, as a consequence, this was a great indication of the strength and esteem Mr. Nixon has held in this country. This poll was held 10 months, or conducted 10 months after that election. It doesn't surprise me at all that Mr. Nixon is far ahead as far as the rank-and-file Republicans are concerned in their selection for candidate for 64. Whether or not this would be so 3 years from today, it would depend, of course, on a great number of events.
I wondered if you thought the results of that poll would indicate that Mr. Nixon should not run for governor of California, but should stay in the race for the presidency.
Well, this would be a decision for Mr. Nixon to make himself. Naturally, from a selfish point of view, I would like to see him run, because as head of the ticket, he would enhance our chances of holding or perhaps gaining congressional seats.
You don't think that would prevent him from running for president?
I do not. I do not.
Gentlemen, Mrs. Craig and gentlemen, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I see that our time is up.
Thank you, Ned Brooks. We'll tell you about next week's guest on Meet the Press in just a moment.
That's the identification of Radio Buenos Aires, comparable to our familiar trademark, the NBC Chimes. This is Leon Pearson in the NBC newsroom in New York. Foreign radio stations are familiar here because we remain in daily contact with correspondents around the world. The result? You get news direct from where it happens throughout the day on NBC Radio News on the Hour.
When the USO is mentioned, what do you think of? Unless you're a member of our armed forces today, most likely you recall memories of World War II. And this is sad, because today is in time of actual war, the USO is still on the job, still serving those who serve our country all over the world. Now in its 20th year, the USO today is as important to the morale of our GIs as it was in actual war. As President Kennedy has said, winning the peace is a lonely battle. And right now, there are 2.5 million GIs all over the world fighting that battle for us. Half are under 25, half away from home for the first time. They need the USO, and the USO needs your help to maintain its clubs here and in 27 countries throughout the world, potentially explosive areas where the war of nerves is matched only by the GIs' battle against loneliness. Support the USO, either directly or through your United Fund or Community Chest. More details about Meet the Press. Our panel today consisted of Richard Wilson, Kohl's Publications, May Craig, Portland, Maine Press Herald, Robert Abernathy, NBC News, and Lawrence E. Spivak. For a printed copy of today's Meet the Press discussion, send 10 cents in coin and a stamped self-addressed envelope to Merkle Press. That's M-E-R-K-L-E, Merkel Press, 809 Channing Street, Northeast, Washington, D.C. Next week, Meet the Press will have as its guest Dr. Walter W. Heller, chairman of President Kennedy's Council of Economic Advisors. Vacationing America stays better informed. Tune to NBC.